everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures, breaks them down into everyday terms for regular people. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my partner and co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. Today, we break down some aspects of criminal law and lead you through the various methods for bringing a criminal case against a defendant. We'll talk about both felonies and misdemeanors and the differences between the two. Let's start off with something that most people don't understand. There is a difference between morality and criminality. Some things may be immoral, but not criminal. Some things may be criminal, but not necessarily immoral. So you need to separate those out. For something to be criminal, a legislative body has to say it is. And that means the United States Congress, for a federal law, a state legislature for a state law, or a city council for a city ordinance. The legislative body not only says what's criminal, but also determines the seriousness of the crime. Too often people think that that's up to the police or a judge. The degree of a crime or the seriousness of the crime in this hierarchy of crimes that we have belongs to the state legislative body, or a legislative body, I should say. Now, all of that said, there are two different kinds of crimes, felonies and misdemeanors, and I'm going to turn to my partner, Judge Gail, to give you a primer on felonies and misdemeanors, and what are the differences?
Well, Judge, as you know, and as you've just educated our audience about, there are two types of criminal offense, which are misdemeanors versus felonies. If you have had any, I guess, relationship or engagement with the criminal justice system, I like to say that most people's experience or initial experience is probably with the lower level offenses, which are misdemeanors. Misdemeanors are offenses that carry less serious, less severe punishment. More often than not, the penalties for misdemeanor offenses are more frequently limited to fines, but they can include shorter terms of incarceration. When we think about fines, fines are financial penalties or financial obligations that are imposed on defendants, because whether you're facing a misdemeanor or a felony, when you are accused of an offense, a criminal offense, you are considered a defendant. And so if it's a misdemeanor or a low-level, less serious criminal offense, then frequently the penalty for that offense is a fine or a financial obligation that you must pay. And it is designed, or the belief, which goes all the way back to the days of founding this country, when many individuals who were considered to have anything of substance were really landowners. And so the idea is that if you required someone to pay or to give up something financially, then that would serve as a deterrent for their behavior. They would become less likely to commit that offense again, because you didn't want to risk losing either the limited finances that you had or any parts of the land that you had amassed. And so perhaps early on, that was an effective deterrent. In my view, imposing fines are perhaps the most ineffective form of deterring behavior. And we can talk about that in just a little bit. But it also is not to the exclusion of imposing a term of incarceration. Incarceration is when your freedom is limited by placing you in an incarcerated state, meaning in a jail or prison. The difference between jails and prisons is jails are designed for shorter terms of incarceration, meaning if you are required to serve a term of not being in the community, but being behind bars, it is designed for shorter periods of time, generally 1 year or less, although some communities may find that 2 or 3 years in jail versus in prisons, which are designed to house individuals for years, multiple years at a time. Those are the major differences between a jail and a prison. I know sometimes those words are used interchangeably, but they do not mean the same thing, nor are they designed to serve the same purpose. The other option is for probation or to serve a term of punishment while still out and enjoying the community. That is also something that can be imposed as a penalty for a misdemeanor offense versus a felony offense. If you think of a felony, think of a more severe offense or a more severe crime that has perhaps higher fine penalties. If they are to be imposed, they are more likely to also accompany longer terms of incarceration in prison, not jail. And if there is a probationary period, then that probation may be more strictly watched or monitored or enforced as opposed to a misdemeanor.
Let me jump in and just say, for example, felonies are very serious crimes, rape, burglary, murder, manslaughter, all those kinds of offenses. Misdemeanors generally are lesser offenses, such as disorderly conduct, assaults, simple assaults, petty thefts with a limit up to a certain dollar amount, domestic violence. There can be some serious misdemeanors that carry some significant jail time. All of them aren't just disorderly conducts or littering. You know, there can be some serious misdemeanors. Again, the legislative body determines what these are. There are also grades of misdemeanors in most states. A more serious misdemeanor at the top, cleared down to maybe a minor misdemeanor, such as I mentioned, littering. In some states, traffic actions, traffic offenses, I should say, are misdemeanors. In other states, they aren't. But some states, if you get charged with speeding, you would be charged with a misdemeanor. So that's sort of the definition of misdemeanors and felonies. Minor offenses, as far as consequence and penalty, compared to major offenses with consequence and penalty.
Indeed, and I want to caution our listeners to please make sure that you also check with your state and your local legislator and the legislative body and the laws in your community, because if we identify a particular offense that we suspect or may even categorize fairly broadly as being a criminal offense, but in your community it's not. For example, there are many states that actually categorize their traffic offenses as civil offenses and not criminal offenses at all. The point of educating you is so that you have a generalized understanding of how these offenses are generally categorized, understanding that it's not necessarily blanketly applicable to every community in any town, USA.
There are different ways for a misdemeanor to get started through the legal system. And I think it's important for us to note those, Judge Gale.
Yes, why don't you tell us about it?
A misdemeanor can be an arrest by a police officer or law enforcement officer where the law enforcement officer observes the conduct that would be classified as a misdemeanor. So there can be an arrest, and then the police officer would file a complaint with a court. Now, there are usually courts in most states that handle misdemeanors. They're called lower level trial courts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're a municipal court, sometimes they're a district court. They go by different names, a city court. You know, they go by different names, but primarily they handle misdemeanors, really high volume courts, high volume number of cases go through there each and every day. But a complaint, a written document stating when the offense occurred, some basic facts about the offense, what particular section of law the person is accused of violating, and the degree of misdemeanor, that's filed by the officer after the arrest. There also can be a situation where there is no arrest. The officer just files the complaint with the court, and the person is summoned to come to court. That's another form of filing a misdemeanor charge. And in some states, a citizen can actually file a misdemeanor charge. Generally, however, the citizen presents the facts to a judge, and the judge then decides whether or not a complaint has been filed. But misdemeanors are minor arrests, maybe holding somebody in the drunk tank for a short period of time, bringing them to court, having the complaint filed, and the case is over in fairly rapid succession.
I love the reference to the drunk tank. That's hilarious to me. But you're right, because it does happen. And when you were describing kind of the different ways that a case can be brought to the court, and how a complaint can perhaps have life breathed into it, one of the very unique ways, which is an avenue available in Ohio, is the fact that a citizen can file a complaint and bring that to the court and have the court determine whether or not the veracity of that complaint merits forward movement on it.
And that was done in Springfield, Ohio, about the Haitians. Go ahead.
Great minds are thinking alike, because that's exactly what I was thinking of, Judge. I was immediately, because you don't see that very often. And the uniqueness of that, I think, kind of maybe threw a lot of people off guard. But the fact is that it is a tool that is provided for in the law, at least in the state of Ohio. Now, that does not mean that that's the case anywhere. And so if you, again, are living in any town, USA, you want to check to see if your state's laws, and especially if your local laws, provide for that kind of access, or if you're required to go through law enforcement in order to file your complaint. But it's not as common. The citizen complaint process is certainly not as common as either the direct arrest by law enforcement or the filing of the complaint, you know, and providing the summons to the alleged defendant at the time. Those are more common than anything. But I immediately, just like you, I thought about Springfield and the process that was undertaken. And I think that process is still on hold. I don't know.
No, the judge found there was no probable cause and did not file a complaint.
Interesting. So, interesting.
The other situation for anybody who's an old TV fan or a classic TV fan and watches old Andy Griffith shows, Andy Griffith and Mayberry, they had a great episode where Jim Nabors' character, Gomer, went around and learned about citizens' arrests. And so he went around just screaming at everybody he saw jaywalking or doing anything. Citizens arrest, citizens arrest. So that's every time anybody talks about a citizen complaint, that comes to mind. That in Springfield.
That's, you know, hilarious. I don't know that I saw that episode, but now I'm intrigued. I'm going to go check it out.
Yeah, but go to YouTube and put in Andy Griffith, citizens arrest, and it'll come up. It's a classic.
And to that point, Judge, and tell me what your thoughts are. I think this really does invest, and in maybe sometimes to the point of abuse, but it does invest citizens with a lot of opportunity to engage their government, whether they've been trained or not, or whether they know what they're doing or not. What are your thoughts about that? Because I think there are benefits as well as detriments to doing that.
No, I think that it's good to have it because you can have citizen watchdogs. You have to have a check and balance because citizens don't, at the average citizen doesn't know the law enough to process it. You know, I was delighted one time that this little old lady in my jurisdiction, I was a young judge, and walked on a don't walk sign when no traffic was coming.
Ooh.
And she grabbed me on the other side of the street and just gave me what for, up one side and down the other, about flaunting the law. If she had known about citizens arrest,
oh my gosh, she may have
arrested the judge for jaywalking.
Right, she would have slapped some zip ties on you right there.
That's right.
She may not have had handcuffs, but zip ties.
I'd have been done. Misdemeanors, though, are short-term cases, don't usually take very long. They can take several months, depending on the seriousness of the case, but they don't take very long. People are not usually incarcerated for long periods of time after the case or before the case. They're not held on bond often unless it's a violent offense. And so it's a pretty quick process, reflecting the fairly minor nature of the offenses. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree.
So let's go to felonies. Let's go to the big cases here, the very, very serious cases. And we hear these all the time. We heard it with the killing of the insurance executive in New York.
And, mm-hmm.
and the manhunts or person hunts that go on in trying to find people. There are so many different ways that you can bring about a felony case in the courts around the country. And let's just talk about a couple. The way I differentiate them, Judge, I talk about the direct way and the grand jury way, okay? So the direct way and the grand jury way. Let me talk about the direct way, and then we'll get to the grand juries. The direct way is where there is a arrest on the scene. The person is put in jail. There is then the document called a complaint filed in a case, which again is the date and time of the offense, the nature of the offense, the severity of the offense, and the code section that the person allegedly violated. That's what's in the complaint. And then there is what's called an initial appearance. And this is in most states where a person is brought to a lower court, not to enter a plea, but for the purpose of setting bond on a criminal case, which is the amount that a person would have to post to a clerk of courts to be released from incarceration. And that we can, that's a whole different show on the different kinds of bond. But at initial appearance, you make sure that the judge makes sure the defendant has an attorney, that the address, the the questions of bond, that they understand what they're being charged with, and then a judge schedules what is called a preliminary hearing. And in some states, this is called a probable cause hearing. And this is a hearing where the prosecution has to present some evidence, to convince the judge that more probably than not, the defendant committed the felony with which he or she is charged. Now, it's called a probable cause hearing because that's more probably than not means probable cause. Now, the prosecution presents actual sworn testimony. The defense and the defense attorney gets to cross-examine that witness. Prosecutors don't like this way of handling felony cases because it allows the defense attorney an opportunity to lock a witness into a story under oath that may change 6, 8, 9 months later when the person testifies at trial. So it allows the defense attorney a great opportunity to sort of see what the case is like. The defense never presents witnesses at a preliminary hearing because they're going to lose. Probable cause is the easiest standard in the world. It's not a matter of winning the hearing. It's a matter of getting as much discovery, as much knowledge about the case as you can at that hearing. If the judge decides that there is probable cause, the judge then sends the case to the grand jury. So it's called a bindover. You've heard the term. The judge binds the case over to the grand jury. The grand jury is a whole different animal. And Judge, I'm going to toss that one to you.
Well, I will say you have done quite a masterful job, as usual, of describing what this process is. And you're absolutely right from a strategic standpoint. I know many a defense attorneys who will demand what's called a preliminary hearing.
I loved them as a defense attorney. Man, I would just ask anything the judge would let me ask.
Yeah, if you could actually get one, right? Because there is also a way to avoid preliminary hearings, because remember, it is the court where the offense took place, even if it's a lower level court, that is the court that is holding the preliminary hearing.
And that's the direct method.
Correct.
But prosecutors can dismiss and take the case directly to the grand jury, right?
Either they can dismiss and later take the case to a grand jury, or if in the window of time, between the time that the court has had the what's called the arraignment or the initial appearance of the defendant and inform them of their right to have a preliminary hearing, and if they demand that preliminary hearing at that arraignment, generally there is a period of time that is granted to provide the parties to prepare themselves for the hearing. So it's not a lot of time, but on average, it's about 10 days. So if there's a 10-day window between the arraignment and the preliminary hearing when the parties are to come back and the witnesses are to be there, and like you said, Judge, as a defense attorney, you get to question the state's witnesses and you can lock in testimony, sworn testimony early on, but you also get a really good sense of what the prosecution strategy is.
Exactly.
With regard to the elements of the crime or the offense that's being charged. It really does allow kind of the defense to get that inside baseball opportunity to understand exactly how they need to better strategize their client's case. That's what happens during the preliminary hearing. However, if during that window of time, from the time that the hearing is requested to the day that the hearing is to take place, The prosecution decides, because there's nothing in the law that prevents this, the prosecution can decide to take the case directly to a grand jury, which is made up of citizens, and those citizens actually hear the basic elements or evidence of the case. Believe it or not, the standard for the grand jury is identical to the same standard that the judge would determine at a preliminary hearing. And essentially, it answers two questions. The first being, was a crime committed? The second question is this the person that likely committed the crime? There's no requirement that those be definitive answers. Is there a crime committed? If there's enough evidence to show that a crime was committed and that answer is yes, then you move on to answering the second question, which is how you return, either if it's in the court, a bindover for the defendant, or an indictment in the grand jury. If that is, and again, remember, both the court and the grand jury would be answering identical questions. So the prosecution could very well bypass the process of the preliminary hearing in the court and take the case directly to a grand jury where there is no, there is testimony that's provided to the grand jury, but it is not testimony that is available to the defense attorney.
Defense attorney's not even present, and the defendant's not present. Prosecution's ballgame.
It is a completely, it is skewed to the degree that it is a tool used by the prosecution to secure or to determine whether or not an indictment is going to be returned. And an indictment essentially answers yes to those two questions I outlined, that a crime was committed, and this is likely the person that committed the crime. And if that is in fact the case, then the grand jury returns an indictment. And you are correct, Judge, during that process, there's only the grand jury members that are there, the prosecutor is there, the court reporter is there. There is no judge in the grand jury room. There are witnesses that are called and are specifically called by the prosecution. So those could include law enforcement and sometimes no more than law enforcement. On the rare occasion, it could include the victim and maybe a witness, but it is not required because the threshold is so low and the requirement is so very low to meet that probable cause standard.
And, grand jurors can ask questions too, can't they?
Absolutely. Grand jurors can ask questions. They can choose not to vote immediately. They can ask for more information. In fact, grand jurors have subpoena power. So if they are desirous of additional information or are in need of more evidence in order to make an informed decision, they can investigate more and they can use that power to investigate to make an informed decision about whether or not an indictment should be returned. In fact, we saw, I think, in many of the Trump cases that the grand jury was used as an investigatory body.
Okay.
Before they were asked to actually return indictments.
Let's clarify that. So a grand jury can react to a complaint that's filed and or a bindover from a lower court. And there they've got the crime laid out for them, and they just have to answer the two questions that you talked about. They have to find probable cause that the defendant committed that crime. That's one aspect of grand juries.
Mm-hmm.
Grand juries then can serve a whole different purpose, and that being an investigative arm of the prosecution. And talk about that. You know, let's dig into that a bit.
And so, again, prior to being asked to merely consider evidence or information that's already been collected to present for this exclusive purpose of answering those two questions and potentially returning an indictment, was a crime committed? Is this likely the person that's committed a crime? Grand juries can also investigate actual cases, and they are vested with what we call investigatory powers or investigative powers. And that power can be used to gather evidence, compel more witness testimony, to determine whether or not the veracity of evidence. They are empowered with the authority to issue subpoenas, and they can use this subpoena power very similar to how subpoena power is used in a courtroom setting when we are anticipating potentially what we call a pettit jury. And so a pettit jury is what most people are used to seeing when you watch Matlock or when you watch Law and Order or any other courtroom drama where jurors are deciding whether or not to return a verdict of guilty or acquittal. That is what a pettit jury is. A grand jury, on the other hand, has more extensive responsibilities. Their responsibilities, like I said, can include using their power to subpoena all kinds of folks without their lawyers being present.
And records.
Without there being, now there is a court reporter, but without there being a formalized record of the proceeding. So you're right when you talk about records.
You can subpoena records is what I was trying to say. I didn't make myself clear. You can not only subpoena people, but records and data.
Exactly. And so issuing a subpoena for actual information minus the person, right? So maybe you want the cell phone records. Maybe you want the medical records. Maybe you want the business records of something in particular. A grand jury can issue what's called a deuces tecum. Or subpoena deuces tecum, which
Man,
is
you are into that Latin stuff. You and you even pronounce it well. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Why? Thank you. But issuing a subpoena deuces tecum is a subpoena to say turn over the records in lieu of the body. Instead of the body, give us the records or give us the information or give us the documents. And the grand jury can then decide once they have possession of them, how, again, they will take next steps. Next steps could be to subpoena an individual to interpret those records or interpret those documents or to provide more clarity for what they've received.
Let's give an example of that if we could. And let's talk about subpoenaing phone records, cell phone records. And then if they have the records, they have the records of all the calls, they may need somebody to interpret those numbers, those calls, that data. Or they may need somebody to interpret the GPS.
I was going to say the process. It may seem on its face very easy to kind of look across multiple telephone records to track when calls were made, perhaps from one device to another, allegedly, or one time or another. But it also is very important. And for any good prosecutor, this is the kind of information you would want to know well before a trial before a pettit jury or well before you ever get the case in front of a judge that's assigned to it. The grand jury may want to know, what is the process of pinging off of towers? What does that mean? How does that work? How far does the distance have to be to transfer from one tower to another? How do we know that this telephone number that allegedly attaches to this device was actually made from this device as opposed to some, maybe ghost call being cloaked and made from another device, but merely made to look like this one? How do you specifically tie a certain device that is allegedly owned by a certain individual to a certain tower, to a certain number at a certain time? And so merely having the document does not necessarily tell the full story of that transaction. But then after you get the documents, to subpoena an individual who's either responsible for maintaining the systems at the cellular company, or someone who is responsible for maintaining those documents, but also has a background and deep knowledge of how this system works, would be amazingly helpful for the prosecution. Why? Because any good prosecutor should know and anticipate that not having the answer to those questions leaves a gaping hole for the defense to challenge if they are to bring this case formally by way of an indictment, if they formally bring this case against the defendant. So these are answers that not only should a prosecutor know for their own benefit, but they should be seeking to answer early on, using the grand jury as an investigatory body to make sure these are answered so that they can respond to these potential defense mechanisms that are no doubt going to be raised, especially if there's nothing in the records that clearly outline how these records attach to this particular defendant that is being held responsible for this particular criminal offense.
Also, financial records. We've been talking about cell phone records, but financial records are often subpoenaed, and often you need an accountant or a business executive to come in and explain those financial records.
Oh, especially absolutely.
In money laundering cases and racketeering kind of cases.
Money laundering, racketeering, when there are multiple companies or shell companies that have been created potentially, when money's been moved around, and particularly if money is discovered to be in maybe offshore accounts or in other places where it may be difficult to track them. Nowadays, consider the fact that money can now be converted into a couple different forms, including Bitcoin. And so in order to truly appreciate and understand, you know, there's the old saying that says, follow the money. In order to follow the money, to understand the path or the process, you now need an expert to help you to understand how, when, why, where, and in what form transactions have taken place. And that's when the use of a grand jury very early on and their investigatory tools can really not only help to shape the understanding of the offense itself, but also to understand how the crime itself may have been committed. One of the things that prosecutors aren't necessarily required to prove is motive. And thank goodness, because sometimes we don't always know the motive. When I was a prosecutor, I did not always know the motive. You just know that something happened. But when you can understand sometimes the path and movement of things, particularly money, then you can then craft a motive, because even though you don't have to prove it, Judge, I don't know about you, every case I ever tried, the jury always wanted to know the why. Even though you may not even be able to tell them exactly, they wanted to know what was the theory.
Oh, as a defense attorney, I would play on that. Yeah. Do you have the whole story here? You don't. You don't know the reasons behind all of this. You know, they just jumped to the accusation. They didn't give you anything leading up to the accusation.
That's
so
right.
There's no way that you can find my client guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. No way.
Well, and then you always go to extra step and say, well, if they can't tell you that, it means they don't know it. And if they don't know that, then how are you supposed to believe them that my client is guilty? If you believe that they even know why we're here, then how can you even believe that we're supposed to be here? I could imagine. I always played in my mind what I thought the best defense response would be to anything I said. And sometimes
you should just call me.
I know, right? Because I am confident your position was winning every time, because it makes perfect sense. Although you don't know the why, do jurors want to know, well, why did they do it? Or, you know, it's almost like that murdering heir, right? Well, the life insurance was increased, you know, 6 months before they mysteriously died, or, you know, never came back from that long jog. Well, why is that? What is behind it? And it's about putting those pieces together. And the last place any good attorney should be putting those pieces together is in the courtroom in front of the jury. In fact, you shouldn't even be putting the pieces together during your motion practice. That the pieces should be fairly, and the picture should be pretty clear and in clear focus by the time that case is indicted.
Okay, now I want to jump in here because, you know, we've talked about complaints and bindovers and grand jury dealing with cases where the defendant knows that the grand jury is evaluating the case. In many of these investigations, I think we have to make it very clear that often the defendant does not know that they're the subject of a grand jury investigation. They may suspect. Sometimes they don't even suspect at all, because grand juries can be places, and you may, as a former prosecutor, have a better term for this, but it's a place where they can bring in snitches.
Informants.
Oh, there you go. Snitches. They can bring them in and put them under oath, sometimes give them immunity and get their testimony without the actual target of the investigation knowing.
And this is perhaps one of the safest ways to do it, because insofar as that's how you refer to them, Judge, which is kind of true, the saying says that they get stitches.
That's how my clients referred to them, and I cleaned it up markedly.
Yes, they do get stitches, but this, because the process is so secretive, and it is specifically designed to
and the jurors are sworn to secrecy.
Then the jurors are sworn to secrecy. It does provide the latitude, if you will, to be able to go through such a process without the worry of, are my witnesses going to be compromised in any way? Is there going to be, you know, a problem with the witnesses? And so that gives the ability to get more thorough, more truthful information, better vetted information. It really, again, it provides for, I think, a better process for prosecutors. I don't think defense attorneys would agree, but it does help with a better process for defense attorneys, for prosecutors, rather.
Yeah, I was going to say for prosecutors. defense attorneys and critics of the grand jury system say often that it's an outmoded system, and it's really something that's just totally manipulated by prosecutors. And the fact that the grand jury brings back an indictment really doesn't say anything. How do you respond to that?
That the indictment doesn't say a whole lot?
No, the whole process is manipulated by prosecution, and it really is not a screening device to screen out bad cases, which is what it was intended to do.
Well, I actually, I would certainly disagree that it is not a screening device, because I think that it is. I think it's the reason why you sit, nine individuals or however many individuals your jurisdiction calls for to hear these cases, to approach them, and they can approach them with the level of skepticism that they may. I mean, remember, in many instances, the only witness a prosecutor may put forward is law enforcement. And just as courts are struggling and suffering from low approval, so is law enforcement. And so, again, I think that there is something to be said for the fact that you have essentially the community deciding how much veracity and how much they believe the accounts of law enforcement, simply or only because they're law enforcement. Judge, I don't know about you, but many times, I would say this many times in court, that, you know, jurors are not required to believe police officers just because they have on a uniform.
Correct.
That's not a requirement. And the same holds true in grand juries. They are not required to. And given the high level of kind of skepticism that law enforcement, in my view, has kind of brought on itself in many regards, that is the skepticism with which it is met, even at the grand jury stage. What we don't know is we know how a case kind of resolves many times when it gets to court and when a jury makes a decision. But we don't know how many of those cases may be turned away at the very early stages. And I think that might help people to better understand and even appreciate the hard work that grand jurors do. I think to suggest otherwise is actually kind of offensive to the folks who are there kind of making these tough decisions about whether or not cases should be indicted, because they don't see themselves, and rightfully so, they don't see themselves as a rubber stamp for the prosecution. They see themselves as kind of individually, uniquely appointed to, again, approach these cases and make a determination as to whether or not there's a crime committed, and if this is likely the person that committed the crime based on the evidence that they're given from a source that they may not fully trust.
Let's talk about some terminology here, just so that we get it straight for our listeners. You know, if a grand jury...
Is it Latin? I'm happy to do it if it's Latin.
No. If a felony starts in a lower court with an arrest, there is a complaint. The complaint is the written document notifying the defendant of the charge and what was underlying, basic facts underlying the charge. That's called a complaint. When the grand jury decides probable cause, it's called an indictment. It's also a written document. Now, there may be multiple crimes in one indictment. Those are called counts. There are different counts to an indictment. A count means a different charge. Both are written documents, but an indictment comes from a grand jury. Now, if a person knows that their case is going to the grand jury, they've been arrested, or they've had a preliminary hearing and a bindover, the indictment is often served, given to the attorney for the defendant. It is served on the defendant in some way. If the grand jury is an investigative body and comes out with an indictment against a person who may not know that they're the subject of a grand jury investigation, that's often called a secret indictment. And that indictment is not presented to the individual until the individual is arrested. That indictment is sealed until the person is in custody. Those are some terms that we hear in the news, and we're not really sure what they mean. And so I wanted to make sure that we clarified those.
Indeed. And there's often very good reason for indictments to be secret. There's a good reason why grand juries are often operating in secret. And many times it is because there is genuine concern about witness tampering, retaliation,
safety of the snitches.
Well, and whether it's snitches or just witnesses, think of the Puff Daddy case, yeah. Right?
Absolutely.
There was absolutely concern that witnesses would be intimidated, witnesses would be turned, somehow their testimony might be tampered or skewed, they might be bribed. Then these are very legitimate. After all, remember in that case, the prosecution anticipated that there would be requests for pretrial release of the defendant. And therefore, they penned a very detailed detention letter asking the court to reject any request to release the defendant while the case is pending, and held everything secret for that reason. Although there is some reporting that, you know, Mr. Combs knew that he was under investigation and it was just only a matter of time before he was arrested, there was really good reason for the prosecution to kind of operate in secrecy given those concerns. And matter of fact, Jack Smith did on a couple occasions as well.
Right. So after the indictment is served, Then the next step in the process is an arraignment. An arraignment takes place in the highest level criminal court in your jurisdiction. Some places it's called a superior court, some places it's called a circuit court, some places it's called a common pleas court. In the federal system, it's the district court. And an arraignment is a time where the defendant appears, is officially notified of the indictment. In fact, the judge is obligated to read the indictment to the defendant, unless the defendant, through counsel, waives or gives up the reading of the indictment, saying, look, I've got the copy of the indictment. It's okay. You don't have to read it. I know what it says. But the judge makes sure there's an attorney there, that the indictment is delivered, that it's understood. The judge goes to a plea, which in a criminal case is either guilty, not guilty, no contest, or not guilty by reason of insanity, which has to be filed in writing, and we'll talk about that in a different show. Normally, if there's an attorney there, the plea is not guilty. Not guilty even if the person's guilty as hell, because they need to buy time to understand the case or to perhaps negotiate a sentence or a plea to the case. 95% of all criminal cases are resolved prior to trial.
Oh, indeed.
So there's always negotiation going on. So it's expected to have a plea of not guilty. If the person is incarcerated, then the judge addresses the question of bond. What will be needed to secure the appearance of the defendant back in court and the safety of the defendant and the safety of the public?
That's right. The term, what I call the terms and conditions upon which you share the community while your case is pending, if you share it.
There you go. But all of that takes place at an arraignment. Now, this is different than when the person initially appeared, let's say, at the lower trial court. If they were arrested and a complaint was filed before it went to the grand jury, that's not called an arraignment. That's called an initial appearance or a first appearance. An arraignment has to be a time where a person enters a plea or has the opportunity to enter a plea. But the arraignment occurs after the indictment. That's my analysis. Do you agree?
You are right. That is an initial appearance, and those can absolutely be used, again, as those kind of investigatory tools or opportunities for defense attorney to kind of scout out the strategy of the prosecution at that time. And it's strategic. It's designed to be that way. But again, you should understand that, you know, that's also part of the process as well. After an arraignment is conducted and after the court has informed the defendant of the charge and informed the defendant of any terms or conditions that they're required to abide by while that matter is pending after they've entered their not guilty plea, then what the court will then set, if the parties are okay with it, they can set one of two things. They could set the matter for what's called a pretrial, which is an opportunity for the prosecution and the defense to continue to discuss the case itself and for the prosecution even to begin the disclosure process of evidence that they intend to use at trial. The defense could also file for or demand what's called a bill of particulars or more specificity of the charges, as well as discovery. And discovery is that process of revealing and disclosing the evidence that's intended to be used at trial. This is often used to help facilitate those plea negotiations between the prosecution and the defense, because the defense now gets to see kind of the full hand of the prosecution. In my experience as a judge, I required that there be full discovery provided, because I don't believe in trial by surprise. None of those aha. So
we're going to have a whole show on discovery because, boy, there are all kinds of games that can be played with that.
Yeah, there is none of that, you know, Matlock. You know how you watch the Matlock and all of a sudden, in the middle of questioning a witness, everybody turns around and watches the courtroom doors because there's going to be some surprise that busts through the courtroom doors.
Yeah.
Folks, that's television. that is not real life. That's not what happens.
Well, I think we've got us up through arraignment. Let's stop there for today. We'll continue talking about criminal cases in a later episode, but we wanted to make sure that you understood at least the preliminaries and the difference between felonies and misdemeanors and all the activities of a vital part of our system called grand juries. Judge, how they find us? What do we want them to do with us? How did they rate us? How did they review us? What did they say about us?
We want you to talk to your friends, your family, your neighbors, anyone that'll listen, and tell them about the wonderful experience you've been having catching Next Witness Please, and how you can find us on any major podcast platform where you find all of your other favorite podcasts, starting with NPR, who we really want to give a big shout out to, and great thanks to NPR through WOUB. They've been extraordinary supporters. And so we are so very proud to be on a public radio network. But you can also find us on Amazon, Spotify, Apple, or any place else, again, that you find your favorite podcast. And don't just find us. Don't just listen to us. We're going to ask that you subscribe. That way, you'll always get notices when new episodes are released. And while you're subscribing, go ahead and rate us. It really gives us an opportunity to know what more you want to hear about. But it encourages the hard work that we're doing as well, because we really do enjoy educating you, because we know you don't trust what you don't understand. And if we can improve your understanding, then our goal is that we also improve your trust.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to me at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics you'd like for us to cover in a future episode, please just shoot me an email and we'll add your topic to the list. Next Witness Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. We thank you for listening. And until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.